Welcome in to another episode of the Baseball America College Baseball Podcast. My name is Jacob Rudner. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Peter Flaherty. And Peter, we are now 10 full weeks into the college baseball season. And sadly, and maybe excitingly, we have exactly 1 month left of the regular season. 4 weekends to play. Lots of conferences still undecided. I don't think that there's any major conference at this point with a clear leader. And of course, the conferences that are going to be one bid leagues, even if they have a clear leader at this point, there's no guarantee that that team is the one that will represent each league in the tournament. But before we discuss anything like that, as always, tell me how you're doing first.
I'm doing outstanding. The weather is finally starting to turn here in beautiful Boston, Massachusetts, probably the last city in the country to turn to actual springtime. But we had the marathon yesterday. It's a sun starting to come out today. We've got a month left in the regular season. It's only going to get more fun and more action packed as we go on. It's hard not to be excited and juiced up about it.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about that. And like I said, I think that this is kind of the time of year where the excitement starts to ratchet up to level 10 a little bit. You know, this is the part of the college baseball season, the thick of it, where some of the big moves are made in terms of standings, in terms of resume boosting, getting into the tournament. Will a team make it or miss? Will they host or not? This is kind of the time where we learn a lot of those things, and teams can now start to position themselves for success after the regular season. One team that we've talked about quite a bit in recent weeks on the show that could be starting to position itself for a tournament berth after maybe looking like it wasn't going to do that for some time is Michael Early's Texas A&M, our preseason number one team. Got off to the worst start by a preseason number one since USC in 1999. They were 10-9 overall at one point. They fell out of the rankings at week five after some more struggling. They've gone through conference play. It was brutal at first, 1-9 to open games against the league. Now, Peter, they sit at a much more comfortable and impressive 8-10. And this week is arguably the biggest week for their season, not just from a mathematical standpoint. You know, they obviously need to win the games and get wins right now, but from an emotional standpoint. They are going to Austin to take on Jim Schlossnagel's number one ranked Texas. Both teams are going to really want this series. And I think I would argue that both teams really need this series to kind of keep themselves on the trajectories they're on.
Yeah. I mean, with A&M, they entered into the season as, you know, they had the highest expectations of anyone in the country. It was a really unique set of circumstances this offseason with how it went down and Coach Schlossnagel going to Texas and Coach Early being promoted to head coach. And it was pretty evident in the early going that they were pressing a ton. Obviously injuries played a hand in their slow start and inability to finish and win games, but they kind of looked dead in the water after that April 4th game at Tennessee, the series opener. They got no hit. You know, it was kind of looking like they'd take a rather convincing series loss against then top ranked Tennessee. And then something just clicked. I mean, that so far, it's kind of been a smallish sample size since that 10-0 loss. But right now, that looks like the potential turning point of the season. And I don't know how many teams, if anyone, can say their turning point in the season was getting no hit and run ruled at the number one team in the country. But they look a whole lot more loose. They've been on a heater recently. They swept South Carolina after that series win at Tennessee. They just picked up another road top five series win over Arkansas. And I mean, this is a series that you're lying if you haven't, that everyone has had circled on their calendar since everything went down in late June and early July. Like, I can't even imagine how up this A&M team is for it. And I know that throughout the week and in the lead up to it, they'll kind of downplay it and say, you know, we're just going to go and try and handle business the best we can on the road and, you know, keep this thing rolling. We're not really focused on anything. I know in that locker room, they are fired up to get to Austin and ball out this weekend. So I'm really looking forward to it.
You know, one thing that I was thinking about, and I'll also say this, I will be in Austin for this series, which I'm really excited to go and witness and be able to kind of talk to everybody and pick everybody's brains just with how they're processing the whole thing. One thing that I was really interested in just kind of thinking about and talking with you about was the emotional aspect of this is obviously very important, like you just talked about. I mean, I think for all the guys in that Texas A&M locker room, be it players or Michael Early or whoever, this is a big series that you're going to want to go win because it feels like a heightened rivalry with the whole Jim Schlossnagel situation. I think it's beneficial for the cleanliness of the series, however, that this isn't just emotionally charged. And I think that that is really important. This is a very valuable series for Texas A&M in that, like I said a couple minutes ago, it's an opportunity to boost its stock further and really start to solidify that postseason resume. And at this point, honestly, if they win this series, we're talking about a hosting resume, not just a tournament resume. I think they already have a tournament resume. And for Texas, if you're Texas, you're competing for the number one seed right now. There's no question about that. You have one of the best records in the country. You've been dominating top 25 competition. You have an elite RPI. And a weekend like this one, especially against a more valuable Texas A&M team, is going to put you in the conversation to be that number one overall national seed. So I enjoy the fact that in addition to the drama, there is real meaning to this series, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. To your point, for me, Texas A&M is rather safely in the field of 64 until it's not. I think it's kind of crazy how much it's been a roller coaster of a season for them. I think at this point now, they'd have to play themselves out of the tournament, which I honestly don't foresee. But I think you also made a great point with this being more than just the like Texas A&M versus Texas storyline series, if that's the right way to phrase it. Because I think if they go into it, you know, super juiced up, super emotional, that's when you could kind of see them start to repress a little bit and try and do a little bit too much. And, you know, I think it's important for them to try as best they can to stay within themselves, so they have been the last few weeks, keep playing their style. And I think that the rest will take care of itself. Like, that rotation is dynamite. They've always had the talent offensively, even with the injury to Gavin Grahovic, we've finally seen it in the last few weeks. And they're just a really fun team to watch. And I think as we veer towards postseason play in the tournament, the pieces are in place from a depth perspective to kind of sustain a run deep into June. I'm kind of curious to see how the bullpen shakes out outside of Weston Moss, but you've seen it as well in various points with that whole deal starting to fall into place. So A&M's in a great spot. Texas obviously is in a dynamite spot for a top eight national seed. They'll be competing, as you said, to be the top national seed in the field of 64. And I think in looking at the rest of the way, the last few series they've got, I'd say it's a pretty not as favorable as you can get, but I say it's pretty manageable for them to kind of hold on to that spot. They're home against A&M, really tough series next weekend at Arkansas, and then they're home against Florida and at Oklahoma. So, you know, I think that they've been outstanding, and it's been pretty remarkable to see how everyone has stepped up in the wake of the loss of Max Ballou due to injury, and he might be back for the postseason. So, everything's clicking in Austin. Everything right now, as of recently, is clicking in College Station. And we're kind of on this fun collision course that'll crescendo this weekend.
No, we really are. And here's the other thing, too. We're talking about some insane matchups throughout the weekend on the mound and at the plate. And who is going to be available from a talent and maybe a draft interest standpoint. I can imagine that scouts are excited to be in Austin this weekend. For example, you've got Jared Spencer, Ryan Prager on Friday night. And that is followed up by Luke Harrison, who is leading Texas in ERA out of the Saturday spot, and Justin Lampkin. And then we go to Sunday, and I think for a lot of teams across the country, you get to the Sunday matchup, and it's like, okay, here comes the offense, because you don't have, you know, your best arms anymore going on Sunday. We're talking about Miles Patton and Ruger Riojas here, two of the guys who, in my opinion, have been among the most impressive starting pitchers in the country. And if you move them to a different team, I think they are probably in that Friday or Saturday starter conversation, but they're on such loaded staffs that they're pitching on Sundays. So this is really a clash of titans. And I think one thing that's really refreshing is, if you asked me a month ago, we were looking at a series between Texas and Texas A&M that didn't really have a lot of intrigue. I mean, I think that it would have been interesting to see the emotional value of the series because, you know, Michael Early would be facing his former boss and Jim Schlossnagel gets kind of this revenge tour game, if you will, against Texas A&M. But at the same time, there wasn't really a postseason implication to the series. Now it does feel like there are some really high stakes in terms of determining things for the rest of the way. And again, too, I think that there are high stakes from an emotional standpoint. If you're the Texas A&M fan base, you certainly don't want to lose this game or this series to Jim Schlossnagel right now.
No, certainly not. I mean, like I said in kind of the opening, like throughout the week and probably even during the series, it'll kind of be this not front or facade, because I think it'll hold true to an extent, but the talk will be, you know, kind of this is a it's just another series. We want to win this one just as bad as we want to win every series, and you know, we're just going to kind of go out and try and handle business as we have the last few weekends. But inside those closed doors, like, this is a series they really, really want. They're going to be super, super fired up for it, and I'm excited to see how it reflects in their play style. And it should be a blast. Like you said, we had this all circled on our calendar preseason. For the first real month and a half of the season, we kind of slowly had it uncircled, and it was really looking like the only storyline to it was going to be, you know, Coach Early against his, or excuse me, Coach Schlossnagel against his former team, and the emotional side of things. But now we've got it recircled again, and it's looking like the Clash of Titans it was always destined to be.
Let's Texas A&M is a great example of a team that stock has risen, obviously, in the last couple of weeks. We were talking about a team that went from not even near the postseason picture to very much in it, if not competing for a hosting spot at this point. There are a lot of teams right now that I think are really good fits in that stock up, stock down category. And that's exactly what I wanted to do with you here. Just kind of assessing the national scene as we get closer and closer to Selection Monday, of the teams that are starting to move into more favorable positions, whether that's a Texas A&M that now looks like it's firmly in the tournament, or a Vanderbilt, for example, which we're going to talk about here in a second, that has moved into a very solid position in terms of its hosting status. Let's talk about those kinds of teams. And I just kind of tipped it off right there. Let's start with Vandy first. Vanderbilt is on a tear right now. They are up to number 8 in our poll. That is a massive jump after they were at number 19 last week. They had a phenomenal weekend against number 3 Georgia, swept that series. I don't think that anybody really saw that coming. If you asked you or I, at least before the weekend started, I don't think that we would have predicted a sweep. And now here we are. Vanderbilt has a top 5 RPI. They're number 8 in our poll, and they are on a roll here. So what has Vanderbilt done for itself, in your opinion, in terms of solidifying its hosting status? For me, and we're going to create our next Field of 64 that'll come out on baseballamerica.com tomorrow, Wednesday, April 23rd. They're a host, a very clear one, and probably a top 8 host at that.
Yeah, not only are they have pretty comfortably cemented itself as a host, but they're right in the thick of that top 8 national seed conversation. And if the season ended today, they would be a top 8 national seed. As you said, they're fresh off a really impressive sweep of that number 3 Georgia. They threw the ball really, really well all weekend, especially J.D. Thompson. He had a career outing. And Connor Fettle put the exclamation point on the weekend with a quality start of his own. But they're number 8 in our rankings, which I love our rankings. I love doing it every week. But they don't matter at all when it comes to the tournament. So, I mean, when looking at the underlying metrics with Vandy, as you said, they're third in RPI, their strength of schedule ranks second in the country. And then they've got a combined 18 quad one, quad two wins, including 13 quad one wins. So, I mean, they're in a really good spot right now. Obviously, the rest of the way, as is the case for anyone in the SEC, it's not going to be easy at all. They've got a road series at Ole Miss. And then they've got Bama, a road series at rival Tennessee, and finish out with Kentucky. So they're in a good spot to kind of bolster that top 8 national seed resume. It won't be easy, but they've got a big up arrow next to its name right now.
And I think a team that has the exact same description is Clemson. I mean, it's a little different because I think, and we've made this clear on the podcast before, but Clemson has always been in the gonna host type conversation for us. We've had them solidly among our top 16 teams now for some time. I think what Clemson has done now to maybe change the narrative and start to trend potentially towards a number one seed, depending on what happens with the Texases and the Arkansas of the world and the Georgias of the world as well, maybe even Vanderbilt, is they haven't really had a hiccup weekend yet. And last week they had another impressive series with a win over Louisville. They're up to number 7 in RPI right now. And the rest of the way, is challenging, but they also will have their opportunities to stack more wins. This week alone, they're going to face Georgia, NC State over the weekend. Next week, they play no midweek and play Florida State. The following week, they play at Coastal Carolina before a weekend series at Duke. And then they finish out their season with a series at Pitt. None of those are easy. I think that they can win all of them. And like I said, we're talking about a team now that's competing for that number one overall seed.
Yeah, this next eight-game stretch here is going to be a gauntlet because they've got Georgia tonight, followed by a really tough road series at NC State. And for just transparency's sake, they were team 26 in our rankings this week, and there was a big-time debate as to whether or not they would have been in. So that's kind of a de facto top 25 series, and then they go on the road and face another top 10 team in Florida State. So they're first in the ACC right now at 35-7 overall and a 13-5 record in conference. As you said, they haven't had a hiccup weekend. They're undefeated in ACC play as far as series goes. Probably its most impressive series win coming this past weekend against Louisville, and a good Louisville team at that, and top 10 RPI team, a top 8 RPI team in that. And they've got 18 quad one and quad two wins, solid strength of schedule. The metrics are in their favor. The overall body of work is in their favor. They're another team that's safely a host right now, and also, if the season ended, a top 8 national seed.
A team that I don't know has that same safety net right now, but is also very squarely in our top, in our, you know, stock up category as we continue to go through this, is Coastal Carolina out of the Sun Belt. They're 30-10 overall, 14-4 in conference play. They're 3-5, however, against quad one teams. Much prettier. They have only 5 losses, quads 2 through 4. This is a team now that is in the top 15 in RPI at number 13. They are climbing in the human poll, if you want to call it that for us, now up to number 16. They were 24 last week. I view this as a team that is probably on the hosting line. And the reason I say they're on the hosting line is because the reality is the Sun Belt doesn't really do you any favors if you're Coastal Carolina. If you lose even a game, it has a dramatic impact on you. If you lose a series, it certainly has a dramatic impact on you. Is this a Coastal team that can hang on to a top 16 seed? Or are we talking about a group that looks really good today on April 22nd, but might not be as pretty in a month from now when we redo this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no reason as to why they can't hang on to, you know, if the season ended today, they'd be hosting label or whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's a very talented group. I think the most unique thing about it is Coastal in years past has taken on the reputation of, you know, they can typically really swing it and drive the baseball up and down the lineup. But lack of pitching and lack of depth on the mound is probably going to do it in the postseason. This year, it's almost the inverse. I mean, they've got guys who can swing it, led by Caden Bodine, who has some of the best contact skills of anyone in the country. But the pitching staff has been ultra impressive. It's 3.65 team ERA, ranks inside the top 10 nationally. And this is also playing at a home park that is known to just be an absolute launch pad. And really not friendly towards pitchers. So that's a long way winded way of me saying that, one, what Coastal's done at this point is super impressive. And two, I think it continues. As you said, it's kind of unfortunate, you know, it's just the way of how it is, but they don't really have a whole lot of room for error playing in the Sun Belt. Like, they'll be punished for one loss a lot more than another team would be, and especially a series loss. So they can't really afford a series loss or too big of a dud the rest of the way. But I mean, I think they continue to roll. They're inside the top 15 in RPI. The metrics are favorable to them. I think, again, I think that they end up being a host when all is said and done.
You know, I just wrote over at baseballamerica.com/college, if you want to go specifically to our college stuff, about RPI risers and fallers in week 10 and just the challenge that is associated with being a non-high major team right now. The resumes are very fragile if you are not, you know, behind the safety blanket of a Power Four. McNeese State, for example, was a 15 spot RPI dropper despite winning its weekend, is now 38 after being in the mid 20s last week, because they lost one game. And granted, that's the Southland, a conference that we're going to talk about here in a bit. But my point stands, which is that if you're a Coastal, the margin for error is so thin. And I like I said before, I believe in Coastal Carolina this year. I think that they're a really good team, especially on the mound, like you said, which is where it's going to really count when it gets into the nitty-gritty of the season. If you can pitch, you're going to go far, which I think that they can do. Again, though, the problem is that you really can't afford any losses, even over the weekends, if you're going to win series, because each loss carries so much weight. For another team that is in a similar boat, but even has that power for, you know, protection, is West Virginia. West Virginia is in the hosting picture right now as we have this conversation. West Virginia also has the number 134 strength of schedule. And the thing that's kind of carried them to this top 15 RPI is the fact that they just don't lose. They're 34-4. And obviously that carries a whole bunch of weight. So my question to you is this: what does West Virginia need to do to continue to stay on the hosting track? The obvious answer to that is just continue to win. But the challenges here are Coastal-like in that each loss, especially against quad two and quad ones, are going to be impactful for a team that hasn't really played a lot of hard teams yet.
Yeah, I think you hit on it, and it's they just got to keep taking care of business. And then looking at the remainder of the schedule, there isn't a whole lot of room for growth from a metric standpoint, I'd say. I think that there is a little bit. Obviously, this weekend they've got a difficult series against Central Florida, and then they round out the regular season in a couple weeks with series against Kansas State and Kansas. So, you know, there are some solid series in there, but you address the elephant in the room, and that to this point it's been a rather weak schedule, and it's only tough series, not only tough series, that's putting it kind of drastically, but it's most difficult series of the year, which was at home against Arizona. They lost it, but outside of that, 34-4, I mean, baseball is the hardest game in the world, and I don't care who you play, 34-4 is unbelievably impressive. They're pacing the Big 12 right now at 13-3. They're top 15 in the RPI, including 21-1 against non-conference opponents, but three quad one wins is a little bit lacking. But as long as they keep taking these series, and they'll be favorites in each of these, in each of their remaining series. So, I mean, if they go out and handle business, they'll hold on to that hosting spot, at least I think. But like you said, kind of to a lesser degree than Coastal, the margin for error isn't super wide, I'd say. A series loss would be somewhat detrimental to its hosting aspirations, but I don't foresee it happening. They're a really good team, and I think that they'll end up, you know, having a Morgantown regional when all is said and done, which would be absolutely electric.
Let's talk about teams that are heading in the other direction. Stock down. There were some notable outcomes in Week 10 as it relates to teams moving in the wrong direction. And again, I will remind people, over at baseballamerica.com/college today, this morning, we put out a story about RPI movers. That's really important this time of year, just because we're considering who's going where. Host status, and like I said, tournament spots are all kind of on the line right now. And that's one of the metrics that's going to matter a ton. One team that had a move from host status pretty comfortably, in my opinion, to not host status pretty apparently, is Ole Miss. This was a really brutal week for the Rebels, who had been having a very strong season to date. A quad four loss to Little Rock in the midweeks, which, you know, you and I have talked about on the show before, the whole midweeks don't matter thing. True, until you lose to a Q4 team at the end of the season when you're a bubble host or a bubble team. Ole Miss did that, and then they followed it up with losing 2 of 3 against South Carolina, which entered the series with just 2 conference wins. It was one of very, very few SEC opponents that you could draw that is going to result in what we're going to call a bad loss as far as the metrics go. And now Ole Miss is 10 spots down in the RPI, from number 12 to number 22. Like I said, probably not a host if the season ended today. What are you seeing from the Rebels, and is this concerning to you?
Yeah, not a host if the season ended today. Last week, they played themselves out of the hosting picture, perhaps temporarily, perhaps not. But back-to-back series losses, obviously the loss a couple weekends ago to Tennessee isn't going to be viewed as a detrimental one, and it's honestly a series they probably should have won. when reflecting on it, but they kind of soured themselves this week. Obviously the quad four loss is tough, and then that's a South Carolina series they really should have won. So, I mean, from a tournament perspective, they're totally safe and totally fine, but they're on the outside looking in as it comes to hosting. But playing in the SEC is a blessing and a curse. You know, I think on the blessing side of things, they've got perhaps a curse side of things as well. But when looking to play its way back into the hosting mix, there's certainly the opportunity to do it. Three of its last four series are against current top 11 teams, with Oklahoma being the lone team outside of the top 10. And they've also got series against Vanderbilt and Auburn mixed in there. So the opportunity is there to play its way back in, but kind of rather slowly, not free falling, but they're kind of going through it a little bit here as we enter the home stretch.
And I will point out, I think it was 5 weeks ago on the podcast, back on another Tuesday, 5 weeks ago, you and I had a discussion about, is there reason for concern with Ole Miss? Because I think if you were watching Ole Miss a couple weeks ago, I don't think that you saw a team that was like fraudulently performing. Let's be very clear. I'm not here calling Ole Miss fraudulent by any means. What I am saying, though, is that I don't think that if you watched Ole Miss a couple weeks ago, you saw a clear host. I think that if you watch Tennessee, you see a clear host. If you watch Arkansas, you see a clear host, or North Carolina or Clemson. I didn't get that same vibe, and I'm curious what it was for you a month ago, 6 weeks ago, when I was watching Ole Miss. I think Ole Miss now is probably performing a lot closer to expectation.
Yeah, 40 games in, they're certainly not fraudulent. Like, this is a really good and high-quality team. But I think, and we discussed it a handful of podcasts ago, but I think you had asked me, you know, what are your overall thoughts on Ole Miss? And I think I said something along the lines of, they'd be a really good two seed and a team I certainly wouldn't want to see in my regional when all is said and done. So, I mean, if, again, not to keep saying, if the season ended today and not keep talking in hypotheticals, but that's probably where they'd fit right now. And I mean, they'll fit in the teams I don't want to see bucket until its season ends, whenever that is. But circling back to the metrics and where they're at, like, top 25 in RPI, top 25 strength of schedule, 9 quad one wins, like, they've got a chance here to host when all is said and done, but they're kind of one of the odd teams out right now.
You can copy and paste this, Peter, when we talk about Georgia Tech. Very similar boat. Georgia Tech, I think a week ago, we were all talking about how this team was going to host Danny Hall's last season, kind of a storybook run here. 7 days later, if we're being honest, I think we're talking about a Georgia Tech team that's looking like a very challenging two seed to host, but not a team that's going to have teams visit it in Atlanta. Bad loss to Miami on the road over the weekend. Miami, one of the biggest RPI winners of the week. So if you're Georgia Tech, I think you did the ACC a huge favor in probably securing it another bid. Miami is likely a tournament team at this point after last weekend. But if you're Georgia Tech, you also did yourself no favors. You are not a host at the moment. And in this landscape of college baseball, it's going to be really hard to get back.
Hiring has changed. When we have an opening, we need a way to organize what quickly becomes a very complicated process. That's why we need Indeed. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. One of the things I love about Indeed is how it makes hiring so fast, because it organizes the candidates and allows me to set up every step of the process right within Indeed's website. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. There's no reason to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Yeah, as you said, it's literally copy and paste with Ole Miss and Georgia Tech, probably a little bit more so with Georgia Tech. Like, they look like more of a two seed right now than Ole Miss. They're outside of the top 25, albeit at 27 in RPI. They don't have a top 50 strength of schedule, but they do have 10 quad one wins. And then looking at the rest of the way, it's not a light schedule at all. You can't really call a schedule light, whether you're talking about the really any of the Power Four conferences. And, you know, you could throw in a couple of non-traditional Power Four conferences in the Sun Belt and the Southland in there as well, especially this year. But I'd say that they probably end up as a two seed when all is said and done. They're going to be a really good two seed at that, but they've got series against Virginia, a difficult one against Louisville in 2 weeks, and then they close it out with a series at Duke that'll be challenging on the road. So last week was really tough. They went over the midweek loss against the number three Georgia. They played well. They were in that game. It wasn't a bad loss at all, but the sweep at Miami was really, really tough. And Miami, as you said, is now one of the biggest stock up teams as well. They're inside the top 40 in RPI. They've kind of flipped a switch here in the last few weeks. They've won three straight conference series. And it's literally been like the Undertaker meme of him like sitting up outside of the coffin. So credit to the Canes, but yeah, Georgia Tech for me is probably ends up being a damn good two seed when all is said and done. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, I still think this is a team that has a run in it, just like all the teams we're talking about, but that's kind of where they stand right now.
I would put Wake Forest in a similar category of teams that are not going to host, but are probably in a position to go on a run if everything clicks at the right time. We've talked really positively about their pitching before, Logan Lunsford and Blake Morningstar in particular, plus a bullpen that's been very good for the most part. Lineup, you know, home to several very impressive hitters, even without the center fielder, Ethan Conrad, who's out for the rest of the season with a shoulder injury. If you look at the metrics, Wake Forest is sitting okay. 26th in RPI, which is ahead of Georgia Tech. They're 26-15 overall. They have the 10th strength of schedule. They're 10-11 in the ACC, 5-7 against quad one teams. This is, again, I think that Wake Forest is a team that we've been really high on. I don't know that I'm fully backing off on that yet, personally. But I'm also here to say that I look at Wake Forest and I see a team that's a two seed pretty clearly. Can they host? Maybe. With a really good run to end the year. Are they going to host? If I had to predict it now, no, but I still wouldn't want to play them.
Yeah, and trying to see a path here, you can pretty easily envision one for Ole Miss, just looking at who they've got left and also where they stand now. You could kind of see one with Georgia Tech, maybe to a lesser extent. Probably with Wake and power ranking these three teams as to who's most likely to host in terms of just a sheer path, Wake probably ranks third. Their last two weekends in ACC play have been rather troubling after that outstanding and emphatic series win at Florida State, in which they won a pair of games by double digit runs. They got swept at North Carolina in equally convincing fashion as it won its series at Florida State. And then they suffered a bad series loss at home to Boston College, and Boston College is not the cellar dweller that it's been, in years past. They're not necessarily world beaters, but they're probably on that next four out line. When we're doing our field of 64, like metrically they're fine, but record wise, obviously that's a series you want to win. But Wake, as you said, right now, they're 26 in RPI, top 10 in strength of schedule, but they're sub 500 in quad one games. And in looking at where there's room for growth on the rest of its schedule, at least from a metric standpoint, it's a little bit tough. They have a road series at Stanford. Stanford's reeling right now. We could do a whole podcast on that, but then it's home against App State, a series against Gardner Webb, a series against Pitt at home, and then they close it out at Louisville. So, I mean, I kind of envision them taking care of business every weekend here on out through the regular season, at least up until that Louisville series. If they don't, that wouldn't be great. But I mean, they probably need some help to get back onto the hosting line. As you said, they're probably in that two seed bucket where it's like, you know, oh crap, we got Wake in our regional, because they can play with and have the talent to beat probably any team in the country.
If I could push back actually a little bit, I would say that I would have a different order than you. I think that Ole Miss would be the clear number one if we were going to power rank those three teams about who was going to slip back into a hosting spot. Clear number one. I would put Wake above Georgia Tech, though, quite frankly. If you just look at the remaining schedule for Wake right now, you're talking, I mean, I hear what you're saying about Stanford. It's also a quad one series. Stanford's number 49 in RPI right now, even though they're 20-17 and have looked terrible in ACC play. It's a road series across the country for Wake Forest. Again, it counts as quad one mathematically. That's big. Gardner-Webb, throw it away. 278. It's a quad four game. Gardner-Webb is 16-25. No big deal.
Even playing, like, not to, sorry to interject, but like even playing that series like hurts Wake. Like they could win in boat race Gardner-Webb three times, but like playing those games hurts them. And one loss, like, I mean, that alone probably puts them well outside the,
that's not well true. Outside,
but solidly that, outside it. So it's interesting the nuances of RPI.
But listen, but here's this. Georgia Tech, after playing Virginia this week, which is a quad three series at home, Virginia's barely inside the top 100 in RPI, they're going to host Western Carolina for three games, Georgia Tech. So we're talking about two ACC teams here that have midweek opponents over the weekends remaining on their schedules. You have two quad one games if you're Wake, quad one series if you're Wake. You have two quad one series if you're Georgia Tech. And then you go to the other metrics. They're basically in the same spot in RPI. Wake is a top 10 strength of schedule. Georgia Tech doesn't have a top 50 strength of schedule. Personally, seeing as though they're both kind of playing teams from the same bucket the rest of the way, I'd have to lean towards the team that we've had a lot of confidence in the rest of the way, or previously. I still have a lot of confidence in them the rest of the way. And again, I think that the metrics will, at the end of the day, favor a team like Wake more than they will favor a team like Georgia Tech, which is why I would give them, honestly, a pretty clear edge if we were going to power rank those three teams.
Yeah, I mean, all very valid. They've got Wake being they've got Georgia Tech beat in terms of strength of schedule. Non-conference strength of schedule where they lack right now is the quad one record. But as you said, there's room to improve upon that as we enter the home stretch. And in looking at each of their schedules, it's pretty fascinating from an RPI standpoint, just generally speaking, it's really similar the rest of the way in terms of who they've got and who they'll play. So it'll be very fascinating to see how it shakes out. I do think when all is said and done, unless they get some help from teams above it and just other results falling into place, I think they probably both end up as two seeds, but you know, there is kind of a tricky path for either of them if they want to get back on the hosting line, though. I don't, not to speak for you, I don't think either of us foresee that.
No. Let's move towards a segment that I also think is really interesting in kind of a similar light here. I'll also add this before we fully move on. We're postseason focused now over here at Baseball America. I think that one thing you're going to notice on the podcast and with a lot of our content right now is looking forward as to how this is going to impact the postseason picture, the field of 64. And one thing that we haven't really talked about on the podcast yet, we've touched on it a little bit more randomly, but this time for the first time in an organized way, is kind of the art of bid stealing. It's going to be a really big year, big deal this year. We have several conferences that are looking like they're on the edge of producing multiple bids this year. And then a couple conferences that I think are guaranteed to produce multiple bids this year that could still steal an extra one and maybe add on to their total and take one away from somebody else. The biggest one to me, Peter, and this is where we'll start this conversation, is the Southland. We have had conversations on this podcast about the Southland before. It's a really impressive year for that league. University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley is looking like potential winner of the league. McNeese is having a historic season. Lamar is having a historic season. In Southeastern Louisiana, we have right on the bubble of getting into the tournament. I see at the moment two teams in McNeese and UTRGV that are going to get into the tournament or likely to get into the tournament. Regardless, though, I view this as a two-bid league and one that will steal something from another conference.
Yeah, so I mean, when talking about bid stealers and kind of how this field of 64 is going to shake out, one, I love now that we're at this time of year where everything is like postseason oriented, because it's fun to talk about just, you know, fun series and high profile series, which we'll still have. But I love getting in the nitty gritty with kind of each game and each series. So just another testament to why this time of year is so fun. But yeah, give me all the chaos with in terms of stealing bids and bubble bursting. I think it makes for a lot of fun. And the Southland is one of those conferences that I'm really fascinated to see. Probably they're the conference I'm probably most fascinated in seeing how the committee handles it, especially if a team like UTRGV does not win the conference tournament. Just from a metric standpoint, I think that's so important when looking at an at-large bid, especially for a conference like the Southland. And metrically, they're the most impressive team in the conference, sitting at just outside the top 30 in RPI. They've got the 63rd ranked strength of schedule. They've got a really good non-conference strength of schedule, and they've got 8 quad one and quad two wins. So I think for the Southland to get 2 bids, it's probably going to end up needing to be a team outside of UTRGV winning that conference. I think for as impressive a season as McNeese is having, I think that that's probably the most viable path for the Southland to get 2 bids, just in looking at the whole grand scheme of things. But as you said, I think it's going to be between McNeese and UTRGV when all is said and done. But Southeastern Louisiana is right on the cusp of being a top 50 RPI team at 30-9 overall, 16-5 in conference. And then in a little bit of a similar breath, Lamar metrically is not on par with any of those teams, but they're 32-10 and 13-8 in the conference. So we've given a ton of love to the Southland throughout the last few weeks. And I think if the season ended today, if UTRGV wins the conference tournament, I mean, I'd say it's probably a 2-bid league, or if UTRGV does not win the conference tournament,
yeah,
it's probably a 2-bid league. What say you?
I would tend to agree with that math. The one thing I would say right now, and this is why this is so hard, because we are still a month away from the end of the regular season, and just looking at it right now, I would tell you that even if UTRGV won the conference, I would be inclined to give McNeese a tournament spot. Top 40 RPI, they've played some good teams, they're on a historic run, they have a great conference record. I would still think that they would get in, and we actually projected it that way. Last week, we gave McNeese a spot in the tournament, even though they weren't the conference winner, or maybe they were the conference winner last week and we had it flip. But one of the two teams out of the Southland, we gave them 2. So somebody made it at large. I do think that the problem was evident last week for the Southland, in that McNeese won its weekend against Texas A&M Corpus Christi, but they lost game 2, and it caused a 10-plus spot drop in the RPI. So you are talking about teams in the Southland right now where you have 3, kind of 4 really great teams in terms of their record and what they've been able to do, but their resumes are so fragile in that they just aren't playing a lot of top competition. It's solely off of the wins and what they've been able to stack up to this point. And so, yes, I think that if I was a betting man, I would say that you're probably right, and that the Southland's path to multiple bids is a non-UTRGV tournament winner. UTRGV leans on its strong RPI and metrics and probably gets in. Really good track record still for top 35-ish, 40 teams who are mid or low majors and can somehow hang on to one of those spots if they don't win their league. So, yes, I agree with you there. The Big West is in a different situation, in my opinion, because I see 2 very clear bids for that league. One for UC Irvine, which has basically been a top 15 team for us, give or take a spot or two, for the last 6 weeks. They were in the preseason poll. They're one of a few teams that has never exited, despite not being a top 10 team at any point. So that's a very impressive team. And like we talked about last week on the podcast, Cal Poly is having a fantastic season and is really pushing UC Irvine, unlike UC Santa Barbara, which is what we would have predicted before the season, to win the league. So those 2 teams to me are in, and probably 2 seeds at that. Hawaii, maybe UC Santa Barbara, if it can go on a crazy run to end the season here, are also in that conversation. If you were asking me, my opinion is that this is a 2-bid league. Is there a chance it can be a 3rd and steal a bid? Maybe, but yes, it's going to be a bid stealer with 2 at a minimum.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty comfortably a 2-bid league right now, with UCI and Cal Poly kind of jockeying for position at the top of the conference standings. And then for as good of a season as Hawaii has had, and, you know, they're sitting there right now at 56 in RPI, and then UC Santa Barbara has kind of gotten going lately. They're just outside the top 60 in RPI, but I don't think that just the overall body of work for either of those teams right now is enough to warrant an at-large bid. I think they're pretty comfortably on the outside looking in, especially when you compare it to the resumes of UC Irvine and Cal Poly. So definitely a two-bid league for the Big West. I think for it to be a three-bid league, you'd need someone like Hawaii or UC Santa Barbara to go on kind of a gangbusters run and be that quote-unquote Cinderella team that wins the conference tournament. And it very well could happen. They're two talented clubs, but for now, I think it's going to be a two-team league.
Well, try this on for size here real quick, Pete. We are talking about a Hawaii team that the rest of the way has to face Cal State Bakersfield, which is 13-27, number 270 in RPI. The reason I even bring that up is not because it does anything necessarily to boost their resume outside of the fact that I think Hawaii should sweep that series. It's in Hawaii. Then, and this is the important one, Hawaii hosts RPI number 9, Oregon State, for 4 games in Hawaii. They will play a Friday to Monday series. If you take 3 of those and then you win out against Cal State Fullerton, which is a game above 500, and UC San Diego, which is a game above 500, both of those teams are outside the top 150 in RPI. Are we talking about a Hawaii team that has a top 40-ish RPI, a really good overall record, and just enough metrics to be on the bubble? The Oregon State series is the point of what I'm saying, makes this really interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty big opportunity, both from a tournament standpoint. I think winning 3 games against the number now 6 team in the country, I think that's a rather tall task and one that's easier said than done. It certainly would help its cause from an RPI standpoint, but I think when looking at the remainder of its schedule, I just don't know if it's going to quite be enough to get them in the at-large conversation. I think that they're going to fall victim to, you know, playing in the Big West and being viewed as a non-Power 4 team. So, I mean, they need, you know, as ironclad a resume as you can have, kind of like almost Cal Poly-esque. Like, it's rather unique. We're talking about the Big West as a comfortably two-bid league, or somewhat unique, at least when you throw Cal Poly in there. But, you know, they're 21st in RPI. They've got a top 55 strength of schedule. They've got 8 quad 1 and quad 2 wins. They played a really good non-conference strength of schedule. Like, from an at-large standpoint, it's tough to poke holes in Cal Poly's resume, a lot tougher than it is to poke holes in Hawaii's resume, just from an at-large standpoint. But yeah, certainly they could, you know, they could shock the world and take 3 or 4 from Oregon State. And then those are 2 really winnable series to boost its record down the stretch against Fullerton and UC San Diego. And they could set themselves up with a wealth of momentum heading into the Big West Conference tournament, which, you know, it would be on paper upset if Hawaii were to win it, just given the caliber of the conference itself. But I don't think anyone would be sitting there floored that Hawaii wins it. Like, it is a really talented team.
Would that knock it down to a 2-bid league for you still? Would somebody get squeezed out if Hawaii won the tournament?
No, I mean, for me, at least right now, not currently. I think, barring something kind of crazy happening, Cal Poly and UCI are safely in the tournament. And it's just going to come down to, for me, like, if one of the 2 teams gets the auto bid from the conference tournament. So I think it's at least a 2-bid league right now, and that's probably where it's going to end up. But
there's a path to 3. There's
yes,
a path.
Correct.
A path to 2 potentially for the American, the AAC, UTSA. We love them. We've talked about them plenty on the podcast before. I also look at that league and I see a couple other teams that are really enticing. South Florida, we've talked about. We've had them in the tournament at one point. We've had this as a multi-bid league at one point. We've even had it as a 3-bid league at one point in our projections, with East Carolina in there as well. East Carolina has cooled a little bit. Great week last week to kind of boost itself back up into the standings. South Florida hanging around on the bubble, probably not in if the season were to end today. I hate that I keep going back to that. And UTSA, like I said, the winner. What's the path here to multiple bids? If you ask me, and I'll just get ahead of it, it's somebody else other than UTSA has to win that tournament. If not, I think it's UTSA's league and that's it.
Yeah. I mean, simply put, it's that, UTSA right now is in a really good spot from a tournament perspective, in looking at just its overall resume and body work, top 30 RPI team, comfortably leading the pack in the American at 30-10 overall, 12-3 in the conference. They've got a trio of quad one wins. They're in a great spot. I think when looking at teams behind it, in terms of a resume growth standpoint, ECU has a couple of opportunities. Mm-hmm. They've got a big game tonight at NC State, a top 35 RPI team. That's a golden opportunity to notch a quad one win. And then the last two series of the regular season, when they host UTSA and then go to South Florida, that's another golden opportunity to put points on the board. I think from an at-large perspective, that would leave it on the outside looking in still. But they'd certainly be in a better position than they are today at 73rd in RPI. And, you know, with one quad one win to its name, that's just not going to get it done. And then South Florida and FAU are also two teams that are kind of lurking, but long story short, it's unless it's UTSA, if it's not UTSA dogpiling at the end of the conference tournament, then that's the only way it's going to be a two-bid league.
And I'd throw Charlotte into that conversation as well before we move on. Charlotte and FAU actually play each other this weekend. Fun Friday night series, which we'll talk about here in a minute. So keep an eye on that. Let's talk about the CAA. This is kind of a quick one just because the reality is very similar, in my opinion, to the AAC. Northeastern is the clear team. In this conference, they are the only team. Forget with the top 50 RPI. They're at 35 right now. They've been super impressive. Forget 75. They're the only team with the top 110 RPI right now. UNC Wilmington is the next closest at 111 in RPI. Pretty much everybody else is having a tough year. We thought for a moment that Charleston was going to have a chance to be super competitive in this conference, but it just hasn't come together for them. The pitching has not been what they imagined. Their offense has been a little bit sluggish as well. This Northeastern team, however, is phenomenal. And I would go as far as to say at this point, maybe I'm sticking my neck out a little bit for Northeastern. If they don't win that conference tournament, they're getting in to the field. Last year, Charleston was the big snub. And so the CAA kind of has a history here a little bit, at least the recent one, of getting snubbed on selection day when it comes to the tournament if their big team doesn't win their league. This year, I think they kind of changed that pace, though. I can see the CAA getting two teams if Northeastern isn't the guy at the end of the day.
Yeah, as you said, it's Northeastern, or if for some reason it's not Northeastern, that's the only way it could somehow get two bids. But I think, you know, again, baseball is so hard, if not impossible, to predict, but I'd be shocked if it's not Northeastern dogpiling at the end of the CAA or Coastal Athletic tournament. I mean, they're almost kind of lapping the rest of the conference with where they're at. They're top 35 RPI team, 30-9 overall, 13-2 in conference. They're fresh off a midweek sweep of Kansas State. And I give a ton of credit to Coach Glavin. He's probably the most underrated head coach in the country for my money's worth, just in being a mid-major program, or quote unquote mid-major program, whatever you want to label them. But just in navigating today's college baseball landscape with the portal and how he's dealing with that and the types of guys he's bringing in and the amount of sustained success he's had year over year is pretty remarkable. And like I do every year, I think I write him in and pencil him in as an Omaha sleeper every year. And the same holds true this season for the Huskies. So that's a long way of saying, unless for some reason it's not Northeastern, it's going to be a one bid league pretty comfortably.
We saved the best one for last in this bid stealer conversation because I find it to be the most fascinating. And that is the Big Ten. Obviously, when you hear the name Big Ten, I don't think that people go, that's an obvious bid stealer. No, they're a Power Four conference. This year, they kind of are, especially in baseball. It's not exactly a conference known for its baseball powerhouses. The one thing I would say is that this year, they are looking like a potential five bid conference if everything goes perfectly for them. Like I said on the podcast last week when we talked about this in depth, so we won't bore you with the same topic again, I view them more as a four bid league. Iowa, UCLA, Oregon, and USC are my teams. But Michigan hanging right there kind of on the bubble, 63rd in RPI. They have an 8-10 record in the conference, 23-17 overall, probably on the wrong side of the bubble for me right now. Minnesota, Nebraska, both in that same category, a little bit further away from the bubble than Michigan is. I think this is a four-bid league. Again, I would just to reiterate, can I see it getting to five, though, and limiting opportunities for another bid conference? Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I'm with you. Four bid league when all is said and done, but I think a couple of teams jockeying for that fourth bid, led by Michigan, who probably has the most, they have the most impressive resume of kind of the rest of the field, if you want to call it that, with the Big Ten. When you look at Michigan and Minnesota, it's really just Michigan. Like, you know, Minnesota's there at top 75 in the RPI. Nebraska's there as well, but Nebraska right now is under 500 overall. They're 7-11 in the Big Ten. Minnesota also 7-11 in the Big Ten, but they're a couple games over five. Like, they're both, their resumes just are lacking at this point. But with Michigan, they're 8-10 in conference, 23-17 overall. In looking at who they have left on its schedule, in terms of opportunities for, you know, for kind of growth, it's not playing in its favor. They've got Michigan State at Ohio State at Nebraska, which would be a quad two series win, or a couple opportunities to get potentially three quad two wins, and then home against Indiana. Like, I just don't think its resume, when it's all said and done, is going to have the juice to warrant a fifth Big Ten team. But on the flip side, like, UCLA is comfortably in. UCLA is going to be fighting for a hosting spot when all is said and done. Oregon, I think, is pretty comfortably in as a solid two seed. They're not going to host, barring something unforeseen, not to be so blunt, but they're just not going to host when all is said and done, unless, you know, they get some help and kind of keep rolling here. But USC is also safely in right now. And then I think you can probably say the same with Iowa. They had a really big sweep of Michigan this past weekend. It was a huge series for both teams. And Iowa right now is first in the Big Ten at 17-4 in conference and 25-11 overall. So I'm with you that I think pretty remarkably that, you know, the Big Ten is going to be a four bid league.
All righty. Let's get into the home stretch here. This is the fun time for Peter. This is the fun time for you, Peter.
I know. I love this segment.
It's time for Picks to Click. That is ridiculous. You know that? I want it to be known that is a ridiculous statement coming out of Peter's mouth. But it is time for Picks to Click. For those of you who are new to the podcast, Picks to Click is our segment to make some predictions every single week. Peter and I go back and forth picking either a hitter or a pitcher. Basically, it's simple. Whoever has the best line scores a point for our team. We divided the game up into a first half and a second half game. I believe I won the first half 6-1 off the top of my head, or 6-2, something like that. And now in the second half, I am down 2-0. Last week, Peter won. I picked Anthony DePino from Rhode Island. He had like the first poor week of his entire season after I picked him. And Peter, you picked, remind me, who did you pick last week?
I picked Caden Sorrell.
Caden Sorrell, that's right.
Yeah,
Caden
and Sorrell. All he did was, I mean, it wasn't a world-beating week. He went, I think, 5-17 and had an RBI in each of Arkansas's four games. Maybe had two RBIs in one of it, but steady Eddie performance against Arkansas nets me another win.
All right, 2-0 for you. Ridiculous. however, it's time for pitchers. We picked hitters last week. Peter going for the 3-0 start to the second half. We got 1 month left. Peter, who's your guy?
So, well, first off, you were kind enough to make this a two half competition, because if not, I would still be in a deep hole. So, I mean, like, we're talking about it before the show, but it's the last couple of weeks are like that meme where it's like Chris Paul hits a huge three to cut like the deficit to 40 points. So overall, I'm still pretty in a pretty deep hole, but I love how much my boys are fighting, and you know, we've still got a lot to play for here down the stretch. But I'll take Zach Root this week. He's my pitcher. Has been, you know, kind of struggling the last few weeks. And then when zooming out at the team level with Arkansas, they've also struggled the last couple of weeks with a couple of series losses. So I think both him and the Razorbacks get back on track this week with a tricky series down in Gainesville at Florida, who also, like, circling way back, they also kind of fit somewhat into that stock up category when it comes to postseason play. But I'll take Zach Root. Competes his tail off on the mound, plus changeup. He can spin it. I think he turns in kind of one of his trademark quality starts.
And I'm going to go with FAU's Trey Beard. He's kind of become one of my guys this year. A strikeout artist, up to 92 Ks so far on the season, despite only throwing 58 and a third innings. He's walked 25. Opponents are batting 172 off him. And if you go over to our friends at 64analytics.com, it's on the hat, you can see that Trey Beard has been as valuable as just about anybody in the country. He ranks second nationally in weighted runs allowed efficiency behind only Tennessee's Liam Doyle. And this week he takes on his toughest competition yet in conference play in Charlotte. And Blake Gillespie, who has been another excellent mid-major arm so far this year. Gillespie threw a no-hitter for Charlotte. Beard is one of the best strikeout guys in the nation. And that's who I'm picking with. And to give you a couple scouting notes and try and do my best impression of Peter, I would tell you that the off-speed pitches on my guy, Mr. Beard, are very impressive, particularly a curveball and a changeup. He's got a very low 90s, high 80s fastball that does its job. He's starting to throw a lot harder, which I think is something that is intriguing to a lot of people. And the quality of the off-speed stuff makes him a really interesting name. And Peter, you can correct me if I'm wrong, for next year in the 2026 draft.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, you hit on everything with Trey Beard, and that's kind of that's probably the most underrated pitching matchup, dare I say, in the country. That's kind of a knee-jerk statement without me kind of diving into the slate. But Blake Gillespie, a likely top 10 round pick in this year's draft, Trey Beard, a potential first round pick in next year's draft. That's a really fun matchup on Friday night between a couple of solid teams. So I'm with you on the sentiments with Beard, and huge fan of him right now and the stuff he's got. And he attacks you from this really tough to pick up 6'9" release height straight over the top. Fastball's ticked up, secondaries are really quality, so he's an excellent arm.
Zach Root and Trey Beard are the picks this week for Picks to Click. Again, Peter leads the second half series 2-0, and I'm looking for my first win. Let's move over to our final section, and that is final thoughts. Peter, wrap us up with your final thought heading into week 11.
Oh man, it's a great question as to what my final thoughts are. I was actually going to hit on, which we kind of already did already, with the underrated pitching matchup of Trey Beard and Blake Gillespie, which we already did. So I guess I will close in saying that midweeks do matter, and sort of continuing the theme of our like kickoff to postseason podcast, if you can call it that, or at least the lead up to postseason. Pay attention to midweek games and how they affect respective teams' RPIs. What we use, at least what I use, is warrennolan.com. Their RPI, it's very, I like how they lay it out. You can see everything from strength of schedule, non-conference strength of schedule, Q1 and Q2 wins. It's a fun website to kind of tool around with. So at the end of each night, I'd suggest heading on over there and seeing which teams have kind of, you know, made an RPI jump, made an RPI fall, you know, what sort of shakes out on a week to week basis, because top 25 polls are all well and good. But again, for better or worse, nobody,
only matter so much.
Yeah. The committee doesn't look at them. So I'd encourage everyone to kind of do a deep dive on their favorite teams' metrics.
And my final thought is this: one of my favorite teams this year, and it's one of your favorite teams, so I speak for Peter with my final thought, Northeastern. What a year that is happening for the Northeastern Huskies. It is impossible, in my opinion, to not be impressed with these guys. The reason, though, that I wanted to talk about them with my final thought this week is because of the week they had last week, and Peter kind of kicked it off perfectly for me. Midweeks do matter. Last week, they played Charleston over the weekend. Charleston came in, or is now, at number 136 in RPI. Not a terribly impactful series. However, they played two games against Kansas State in the midweeks up in Massachusetts. Kansas State is a top 50 RPI win, and they helped vault the Huskies to number 35 in the RPI. Like we talked about, this is a team that looks like a tournament squad, even if they don't win their conference tournament. And as I've done every week, I've tried to highlight a team that is making noise that we might not be giving enough love. Northeastern is certainly that team for me. And for this podcast, that's going to do it. We would encourage you one more time to head on over to baseballamerica.com/college to get all of our college baseball content. We're coming out with new stuff every day at this point. And as I said earlier on in the show, we're at that time of year now where the postseason is the focus. We're going to be having lots of postseason stuff from Bubble Watch to RPI Movers to the Field of 64, the podcast every week moving forward for the rest of the season. Conference tournaments are coming up. At-large bids are being stolen and taken, and we're covering all of it. So again, head on over to baseballamerica.com/college to check all of that out. And for Peter Flaherty, my name is Jacob Rudner, and we will see you in week 12.